beginning our fourth session. We have one more left. 2 weeks ago, oh, see, there's some new people here, so perhaps we'll also have some introductions in a minute. 2 weeks ago, just a reminder, we concluded our discussion of allegory and midrash, both in rabbinic literature and slightly in Christian literature with origin, and the way that the Song of Songs has been interpreted either as an allegory to the relationship between God and Israel, or as an allegory to the relationship between God and the soul of the believer, the church, etc. And then we moved into the Middle Ages with Boccaccio's Decameron and traced how he uses the allegorical interpretations of the garden in the Song of Songs in the Middle Ages, the garden as the monastery, the garden as the soul, the garden as the sun, all these allegorical interpretations of the Song of Songs, how he uses them and actually plays with them and returns them into their sexual or what might be perceived as their sexual origins in the Song of Songs. So he actually builds some kind of ironic double-layered text in which, on the one hand, the garden is back, returns to become this erotic space as it is in the Song of Songs, but is it has this other layer, this Christian allegorical layer, where the garden is also the garden of the monastery and the body of the nun, and all of these, and Jesus is the gardener, and all of these possible interpretations are all there in the story of Mazzetto, who pretends to be a mute gardener in order to penetrate the monastery. So this is basically where we're at. Today we'll move a bit forward into. We'll begin with the Middle Ages, still in the 13th century, and talk a bit about the place of the Song of Songs in mystical interpretations. We'll take a look at one fragment from the book from the Zohar, which will probably take us just one fragment, but a lot of time. And we'll see how this fragment echoes in, hopefully we'll get to that, in modern Israeli poetry, in two poems of one Israeli poet, which will basically lead us to our next session, where we'll discuss the Song of Songs in modern Hebrew and Israeli literature. So we're kind of going to do this move from mystical literature to poetry influenced by this literature, and we'll take a look at that. But since we do have some new people here, I'm happy to see you, so perhaps let's just have again this brief. The verse we'll be discussing is just really one verse from Song of Songs, chapter 2, verse 1, which in Hebrew goes as follows. Anicha v'tzelet ha-sharon, shoshanat ha-anakim. I think in the translation you have it translated, I am the tulip of Sharon, the daffodil of the valleys, or something like that. The translation we'll use today, just because translated actually as I am the rose. I am the rose of Sharon, which basically means that the interpreters of the Song of Songs are not sure to which flowers are we referring to, daffodils, tulips, lilies, or roses. We'll use this just for the sake of convenience, because this is the translation used by the translations we are going to discuss today. So this is the one verse we're going to discuss, and we're going to, this is the female beloved describing herself in quite an early stage in the Song of Songs. She says, I am, the rose of the Sharon, or the lily of the valleys, and then he says to her, she is like a rose between thorns. So this is the imagery that we're going to focus on. And what we're going to read together is a very, very dense package from the Zohar, trying to explicate this verse. Well, if we know which flowers they are, but yes, basically, yes. I think both roses, I mean, I'm trying to think if I have like in the Bible, if they are referred in other places as having a fragrance.
If rosemary,
yes, but exactly, but I would assume that yes, but this is an assumption. I can't say for sure. We will see that there will be mentions of fragrances in the text we'll discuss, but so it's in the air. But again, we have it's part of this. Since the Song of Songs is so like deeply imbued with nature imagery, but it has been interpreted for many generations by readers who have not been part of the specific natural scene where the text has been written, and we're not always acquainted with the specifics of the flowers or the animals or the trees. So there is many of the readings are trying to reach this imagery without actually knowing what is discussed, and we'll see this gap from time to time as well. So this will probably be, it's impossible to have an introduction to the Zohar, but I will say a few words because it is such a complicated text with a very vexed history. But the Zohar has been written or discovered around the 13th century in Spain. I'm saying written or discovered because this is already where tradition and scholarship separate. According to tradition, it has been written by Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, who is a second century sage from around the time of Rabbi Akiva, whom we've met 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago. And that text has been somehow lost or disappeared and resurfaced in the Middle Ages in the 13th century. Academic scholarship tends to think otherwise, that it has been written by Kabbalists and mystics from Spain. At first it was thought to be written by one, Rabbi Moshe de Leon, but now it is considered to be written by several. Circle of Kabbalists, which has written it in a way that would make it look as if it's an ancient text. It's written in Aramaic, which is a language not at all used in 13th century Spain by Jews anymore, and it's a very strange kind of Aramaic. It's an Aramaic which looks as if it should be an ancient Palestinian Aramaic, but it has strange words which don't fit in, which is one of the clues to those who think that it's not an ancient text, as it seems to be. And it's written in Aramaic, and most of it is written in a sense in a midrashic form, in the sense that it takes a verse and tries to explicate it and reveal its secret meaning, and in this sense, it's a text which is quite different from other Kabbalistic texts written at the period, which are more systematic and try to explain structures of metaphysical and mystical truth, how the Godhead is structured and how what is the relationship between the upper world and the lower worlds, and other Kabbalistic texts of the time are very well structured, and their purpose is to somehow explain us these mystical structures. The Zohar is much more a piece of literature in this sense, in which it takes verses from various places in the Bible and rereads them and does some kind of midrash on them in order to reveal their secrets. So therefore it's also a much less structured work. I mean, it's very difficult to take one rigid worldview from the Zohar as you might take from other texts, Kabbalistic texts, because it actually responds to biblical texts, explains them, moves to this verse and then to that verse. It has much more of a fluidity and playfulness to it. So it's a richer text in many senses, but also a much more puzzling text because of this quality. And the Song of Songs is one of its favorite books to explicate. I mean, the book the Zohar, as it is edited today, as it is has been structured, begins, the first verse that is explained in the Zohar is one of the verses from actually the second verse we've just read, Koshoshana ben Achokim, like as a lily between thorns, is the first verse to be explained in the song, in the Zohar. And the Zohar returns again and again to verses from the Song of Songs as some kind of I don't know, Ur-text that the Zohar will refer to and discuss again and again. Its presence is very much felt. It is all on another layer. It might be also be connected to the fact that many of the imagery that the Zohar uses in order to discuss mystical truth and the relationship between God and the world, God and Israel, and also different aspects of God himself, much of the imagery is erotic and sexual. The Zohar has a strong erotic component to it, and many relationships are eroticized in the Zohar. The relationship between the Torah and the person learning the Torah is eroticized. The relationship between God and the person worshiping God is eroticized. And also relationships between various aspects within God are eroticized. Because one of the aspects that medieval Kabbalah, veins in medieval Kabbalah establishes is the notion that although God is one, and this is not disputed, God has various manifestations. And these various manifestations have relationships with each other. So, and this has been also part of what has been strongly debated against Kabbalah as a whole and against the Zohar as well, that this is already doesn't seem very much monotheistic, but there has been this elaboration of a notion that God has various, I would say perhaps faces, or, and we'll soon elaborate on that, and that these various manifestations or faces of God are, in a sense, entities, and as such, they have relationships with each other. Are we okay up until now? Mm-hmm. Question? Okay. One of the ways of the Zohar offers of thinking of these manifestations, and again, it's not as structured as I'm going to say talk in the Zohar as I'm going to talk about it now, because the Zohar rarely gives us this rigid structure. But the Zohar would talk about these various manifestations as sfirot, 10 sfirot. Sometimes. I think wrongly translated as spheres, but I'm not sure this is the correct translation of the word. 10 sfirot, which are again, in lack of a better word, 10 manifestations of God, in which God, who is basically infinite and therefore we cannot in any way grasp or understand or God cannot reveal himself in the world because he is infinite and the world is limited. God narrows himself into these 10 manifestations, and through them reveals his various aspects to the world. Now, the structure of the 10 sefirot, which is, I will not detail the 10 sefirot now because this will take much more time than what is needed for us today, but I'll just, usually it's portrayed, okay, these are the 10. This a structure which has higher and lower sefirot, and the higher sefirot are closer to the infinity of God, and the lower are more
dense.
That perhaps would be a good word. Yeah, I want to say material, but they're not. But they're more dense, so they're further away from this for the more infinite and abstract aspects of divinity. This is also divided into a right column, which is usually related to mercy, a left column, which is usually related to judgment, and the mid and the middle column, which is some kind of balance between the two. I know this is extremely abstract, but hopefully as we will discuss and read some of this, we'll clarify. So. And one of the images that this will have various images. This will be sometimes seen as a human body in which each tefillah is a part of the body. One correlates to the arm, to the left arm, and one to the right arm, and one to the torso, and one to the right leg, and to the left leg. You can see it also sometimes as a tree. There are various images that the Kabbalistic writings will use for this. But one image that might be interesting for us today is also the image of flow. That there is some kind of flow of divine influence or divine, what the word could be perhaps shefa, which is, means some kind of abundance, from above to below, that these, that the sefirot is some kind of structure, almost a structure of like pipelines, a structure that somehow allows this flow to move from divinity to the world or worlds and sustain it. And therefore, all this structure, there will be some kind of movement and flow between all of these as they reach at the end. You will have this all movement, and it will reach at the end over here, and will reach the lowest tefillah, which will be of interest to us. So I'll talk about this tefillah a bit more, which is usually called malchut. So it's only one of its name, malchut, which means kingdom. And sometimes it will also be referred to as Shekhinah. Now, this sefirah is of interest of us today, because in this whole structure, the lowest, the tenth sefirah, which in this structure is also the lowest one, is the one, first of all, closest to the world. So in a sense, it's the one that, if we're talking about a flow of abundance, then it's the one that gives us all that's above. She's also on the threshold between the world and this divine structure. And it's usually, and it's almost always perceived as a feminine sefirah, as almost a female character. Shekhinah, this word Shekhinah, it will be used many times as the feminine aspect of God, or God's female part, which is an interesting aspect of itself, and we'll see part of it over here. Sometimes it will, doesn't have really one name, but a variety of names, and we'll soon see how many of them are used. So it's not, it's like a cluster of names, or a cluster of associations which form what we would serve, what we call a sefirah. Sometimes it will also be called Knesset Israel, which we translated as perhaps the assembly of Israel, but it's not the specific, it's not the Jews, the concrete flesh and blood Jews, but the more abstract idea of a collectivity of Israel. Now, once the Shekhinah is perceived as a feminine entity, a female entity, then this notion of flow that we have discussed up until now is many times imagined not as a structure of pipelines, but as a sexual intercourse, as the flow of, for example, semen or energies between the male, mostly male, the divine structure over here and the female aspect here. I mean, for example, this tefillah, which is called many times Yesod, is many times imagined as a penis. So, and therefore, when this structure is whole and divine abundance can flow, it's only when these two are connected, and there is some kind of sexual, or, well, something which is imagined, or maybe not even imagined, as some kind of sexual union, which will allow divine abundance to flow. If these two are separated, then abundance doesn't flow, and many bad things happen to the world. And therefore, part of the mystic enterprise is to somehow unite God and the male God and the Shekhinah, because this allows the world to be well balanced and blessed and in harmony. Once this union is disrupted, then bad things happen. Up until now, questions? What?
Can we go back to the beginning?
Back? Yeah, let's do this again. No, really, seriously. Okay, this has been quick, but just this hopefully will give us some kind of clue of what we're going to read now.
You want to fill in some of the blanks just for the sake of...
Yeah, sure. Okay, so the top one is usually called Keter, which is crown. And then this is called Chokhmah, wisdom. There are also others here which are also considered feminine, but the most feminine is Shekhinah, because part of the notion, I think, the Zohar has is that usually femininity is understood also as an act of receiving, as being receptive. And therefore, many of these are receiving flow from other sefirot, but also delivering the flow onwards. So they are feminine in respect to other sefirot, but masculine in respect to others. But since the Malchut, or the Shekhinah, is perceived here as the one which receives everything from everyone, it has the perhaps more strongly feminine aspect. But okay, so this is Chokhmah, this is Binah. That we don't have here, that because it's in other structures. This one would be called Chesed, which indeed usually means mercy. This is would be called, sometimes you'll find it also either as Gvura, which means strength, or I don't know, or Din, which means judgment. So that's this one. This is called Tiferet. Yeah, we could translate it as splendor. And it's actually this one. This is the, you can see it's like the center of the whole structure. So it's the heart or the torso. And sometimes it would be called HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is the name of one of the names we use for God. So it's, sometimes this is considered as a central aspect of what we conceive as God. And then these two are Netzach and Hod, which are, I think, the most obscure of all, and are usually much less discussed, so we won't discuss this. Usually the ones which are most strongly discussed are either these upper three, which are more, you could say, in the head, Keter, which is the crown, Chokhmah and Binah, which are both intellectual facets, like wisdom and intellect, Chesed and Din, which are the two arms, the mercy and judgment, Tiferet, which is the kind of the torso which unites them, Yesod, which is the penis, and then Malchut, which is the feminine, the female counterpart to it all. So that's basically the structure. Okay? Or not. Yeah. Yeah. So usually you would find interpreters of the Zohar speaking of Chokhmah as the first spark of an idea or a notion when it's still abstract, and Binah is the elaboration and systematic development, right, of that thought. So, for example, you could think of this as Chokhmah and Binah, perhaps as intellect, as the more, you know...
The birth of an idea.
Chokhmah would be conceived as the birth of the idea, and Binah is... For example, Binah is... This is interesting, speaking of feminine imagery.
Chokhmah would be perceived as father, as a father figure, just, you know, the birth, you know, like the seed of a thought, and Bina would be perceived as the mother, where in her womb this notion is being nurtured and grown and becoming a whole organism. So she is, another imagery would be that she is the mother of this whole structure, while she is the, while Malchut would be the daughter. So it also has this kind of family relationship of father, mother, son, and daughter as well. So that's another image of the Lord.
Okay.
These guys had a lot of time on their hands.
Oh, yes. this, hopefully will help us a bit in order to read and unpack this very short passage, which discusses the verse, I am the rose of the Sharon and the lily of the valleys. So this is from the Zohar. The translation is from a book called The Wisdom of the Zohar, which is an English translation of a Hebrew translation of various fragments from the Zohar, which has been conducted in the late 40s, early 50s, by an Israeli scholar called Ishaya Tishbi, who published in Israel, taking just, you know, like what he thought are the core passages from the Zohar and translated them into Hebrew, and then this has been translated into English. The Zohar, the whole Zohar, is now in the process of being translated into English by Daniel Matt.
Amazing.
An amazing project, but this, we have this, you know, already framed, so I took it from an older translation. Rabbi Simeon began by quoting, I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys. We can already see that the language is a midrashic language. They quote a verse. We've seen this a bit also when we talked about Rabbi Akiva. They quote a verse and then they try to see what it means. But we'll see that the way they conduct the midrash is kind of different with what we've seen up until now. Rabbi Simon began by quoting, I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys. How beloved is the assembly of Israel to the Holy One, blessed be He. For the Holy One, blessed be He, praises her, and she praises him, without ceasing. And she summons a great many to utter praise and song without cease to the Holy One, blessed be He. Blessed is the portion of Israel which they take hold of, the lot of the sacred portion, as it is written, for the portion of the Lord is His people. Okay, the last sentence is a bit obscure, but the beginning is quite straightforward, and we can actually see this kind of statement in the Midrash as well. The assembly of Israel is beloved because to God, the Holy One, blessed be He, because He blesses, praises her, and she praises Him. This we already found in the found this notion in the rabbinic writings, that the Song of Songs, one of the main aspects that makes the Song of Songs unique is the fact that both sides praise each other. It's not God, just God praising Israel or Israel praising God. We have some kind of mutual or reciprocal dialogue in which both sides praise each other. Although already when we speak about the assembly of Israel or Knesset Israel, in the word of the Zohar, this would mean this tefillah. Okay, it's already a code. So while if we find this in the Midrash, we'll just think of Israel as some kind of collective people. Here it has also a specific metaphysical meaning. It's this tefillah, and the Holy One, blessed be He, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, would mean this. But again, this is less our this is less of our focus. I'm skipping the whole portion thing because it's irrelevant for us this time. So we have already, before we even began, that this statement, I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys, is connected to the assembly of Israel, to Knesset Israel. Because this is just by this statement, Rabbi Shimon began by quoting, I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys, how beloved is the assembly of Israel, we already have this linkage, that the rose and the lily is the assembly of Israel, which, after several thousand years of allegory, it shouldn't come as a surprise, right? Right. The rose and the lily, being Israel, should be commonplace by now for us as readers. No big surprises there. But let's see how they elaborate this notion. I am a rose of Sharon. This is the assembly of Israel, which stands in radiant beauty in the Garden of Eden. Okay, here are some things we didn't know. So, can I erase this? Let's not interpret yet. Let's just, you know, have this in mind and see what kind of picture it develops. Sharon, what is Sharon? For us, this perhaps be easy because we know there's a area in Israel called the Sharon, but it's a strange word. Sharon, because she sings to Shara, mm-hmm. Yeah, Sharon, the Shir, she sings to and praises the supernal queen, king. So, and she's Sharon because Sharon is derived, according to the Zohar, from Shara. Now, already here we have, they don't seem to accept the last aspect of the rose singing. Chavatzelet HaSharon is the singing Chavatzelet, the singing rose, which has some kind of explanation in the word Sharon. They don't seem to bother to explain to us where they took the Garden of Eden from, right? It's a given for them. What does it mean she stands in radiant beauty? These two aspects they just tell us about, and not necessarily they don't feel to kind of give us a verse to prove it or anything. For them, it's a given that this flower singing praises is located in the Garden of Eden, and it's of radiant beauty. Okay. Another interpretation. I am a rose of Sharon, for she wishes to be refreshed by being watered by the deep river, the source of rivers, as it is written, and the parched land shall become a pool. Okay. This is becoming more and more obscure as we move on, and you see, we're not over yet. I am a rose of Sharon. She wishes to be refreshed by being watered by the deep river, the source of rivers, as it is written, and the parched land shall become a pool. Okay, this one is difficult. Yeah, we have to know this. Let's open Isaiah first of all and see Isaiah and see what the verse that they're referring to is. So the Hebrew is for parched land. Okay, Isaiah says, "V'haya hasharav le'agam." The parched land will become a pool. The Hebrew word for parched land is sharav,
which comes from the south. Which comes from the desert.
Yeah, today we use this word for
Chamsin.
Right, for Chamsin. This will be the word for Chamsin. But here it's used, or at least the truth, as a parched land, a land which yearns for water. So she's called Sharon not because she sings, but from Sharav. And therefore, it's not about singing, but about being yearning for water. It's a very different kind of flower we have here. It's not the flower which sings, but the flower which yearns for water. But the Zohar doesn't stop with that. They say not that she yearns for water, but she yearns for water from the deep river, which is the source of all rivers. Now, even before, and I'm not sure I'm not necessarily able to decode what is perhaps the Kabbalistic meaning of this or that. We can feel here that this flower is gaining mythical proportions. Right? She is in the Garden of Eden, and she is to be watered by the greatest river of them all, which is the source of all rivers. So even before we start decoding the text, there is a feeling that from a specific flower, we're almost in the land of, you know, the Little Prince, where one rose is the whole world. But there is a sense, she is in the Garden of Eden, and she's yearning to be watered by a specific river, which is the greatest river of them all, and the source and father of all other rivers.
But the second interpretation, mm-hmm. another interpretation,
yeah.
doesn't place her in the garden.
Okay, I agree. I would say the overall text gives us different mythical picture. That would perhaps be a more accurate image. The first image talks about her being in the Garden of Eden singing. Another one would say, no, she's actually yearning for water from some great river. This way or that, we're in some kind of mythical imagination. Yeah, it's true. We shouldn't combine these two pictures together. That's a good point. Now, if we think, if we return to this image, and we talked about the Sefirot, and we think of this, and we talked about the last Sefirah, the Shekhinah, in this case the rose, as being the receptacle of all flow, of all flow that is supposed to arrive to her, then of this divine abundance, which is imagined as flow, perhaps we already have some kind of hint of this with this notion that she's eager to be watered by this deep river, which is the source of all rivers. Yeah, this one river where all rivers, you know, separate from, and she wishes to receive water from that river. It's perhaps not yet a sexual image at this point, but it is one which has to do with some kind of mythical flow, this deep river which she wants to receive water from. So already this might echo what we've seen earlier. Are we okay? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
A lily of the valleys, because she stands in the depths of everything.
So first of all, this it might make more sense a bit in Hebrew. Because in Hebrew, Shoshanat Ha'amakim, the word for valleys is emek, or amakim, which comes from amok, which means deep. So standing at the depth of everything in Hebrew would mean be'omek hakol. So we had her one image of her in the Garden of Eden. Here we have a different image of the lily as being standing at the depth of everything, which is a very enigmatic phrase, which we can take to many directions. Is this that she's the deeper truth of everything? Is that, you know, she's like the deepest aspect of everything? Or is it that, you know, perhaps in the structure of the Sefirot, which we've just seen, that her being the lowest Sefirah means that she's at the depth of this structure of the 10 Sefirot? Yeah, all this 10, she's at the depth of this structure. I don't know yet, okay? And I'm keeping this enigmatic, because I think the text is not, there's a poetic quality to it, which I don't want to, you know, give one interpretation to close it down. But we have the notion that this lily is standing at the depth of everything. Again, in mythic proportions. She's not at the depth of this or, you know, in this valley or that valley in a specific geographical place. No, she's at the depth of everything. What are these valleys? It is similar to the verse, out of the depth I cry to you, O Lord. Okay, and this is an interesting connection. Mima'amakim krati chaya. From the depth, Mima Amakim. Yeah, how would this one translate it here?
Out of the depth, I cry to you, O Lord.
Out of the depth, Mima Amakim. Here we have Shoshanat Ha'amakim. This is from Ma'amakim. The words are close enough for the Zohar in order to make a connection. So now we might have some hint of what could be the depth of everything, because what does it mean that the person writing the Psalms cries to God from death, out of death? What possible meaning could that have? Why is this connected?
Sorrow.
So death could mean sorrow. Good.
Despair.
Anguish. Okay. Okay.
Pain.
So the. And you might. I don't know if you know that in some ancient synagogue, there the place of the Baal Tfilah, the Shliach Tzibur, the person who is leading the service, is actually a bit lower than the rest of the synagogue. I think you can find this in Mitzadayin and other places. So he's actually. He's physically deeper than the other person praying, people praying. But now here they're doing some jumps here, which we have to kind of follow and try to understand why they're doing it, because we have a lily in the valleys, and they're taking this word valleys and they're saying, okay, we're not talking. This is not. A botany class. We're not going to go into some kind of valley and find lilies in the valleys. This is not what they're interested in. They're saying the valley itself is an image, and this image is an image of depth. Because in Hebrew, at least, Amakim echoes this notion of depth. This depth, whatever it means, has to do with the motion of crying to God. So being located in the depth here, if we have the rose singing to God or yearning for water from this deep river, here we have a lily that, being located in the depth, is not just where she is, but the disposition from which she cries out to God. This is a disposition of prayer. Hence the Zohar, in saying these valleys are—it's not just a—I would say it's not just a geographical place; it's a relationship. Yeah, in the same way that Shalom is not a geographical place but a relationship. It's a relationship of singing or praising, or a relationship of yearning for water. But neither Shalom nor the valleys are just the place where they are. It's the place where they relate to God or water or these specific geographical places are becoming images of relationship between this flower and another entity. A rose of Sharon, a rose from that watering place. Okay, they were going back and forth. You see this comes again. A rose of Sharon arose from that watering place from which the rivers go forth without cease forever. A lily of the valleys, a lily from that place called the depths of everything, enclosed on all sides. Whew. Okay, let's see this one. There, it seems that, in one sense, it seems like they're kind of perhaps summing it up, but with some variants. They say, a rose of Sharon arose from that watering place from which the rivers go forth without cease forever. So actually, here the rose is not waiting for the rivers, but she's actually located where the rivers continue onwards. Interesting. And a lily of the valleys, a lily from the place called the depths of everything, this we have seen, but with an addition, enclosed on all sides. So she's not just the valley, and here perhaps we also have a physical image of a valley. This valley is protected. This flower is contained. It has. Exactly. This we'll see in a minute. In a minute, they will say that actually they're not the same flower, and this will be a very interesting leap that they will do with this verse. But before we do that, I think they're already hinting at it here.
Yeah, the rose of the Sharon is actually in a place where water flows from everywhere, and the lily is the lily of the valley is enclosed. But before we go there, I just want to show that I'm trying actually not to dwell too much on the Kabbalistic meaning, but just to try to create the kind of character that they're making of this flower. Because as we move along slowly in the text, these flowers are turning into richer and perhaps even more personified images. We started with flowers, but these flowers have relationships. This is really the little prince. They are praying or singing or praising or yearning for water, and they are also there is a stronger sense of them being protected, contained, enclosed. Their location is becoming, in a sense, more specific. This one verse is becoming more and more detailed in order to create these flowers as characters, in a sense. And I'm trying to kind of get a glimpse of what these characters are. Okay, and then we move... Can we continue? Okay. And then we move to your suggestion. Come and see. At first, she is green like a rose. I don't know. Whose leaves are green. Afterward, a lily. She is red with white colors. Shoshana, I'll read a bit and then we'll unpack this. Shoshana, which means lily, with six leaves. Shoshana, because she changes from color to color and varies her colors. A lily first arose when she wishes to unite with the king. She is called Rose. After she has become united with him, with the king, with those kisses, she is called Lily. Since it is written, her lips are lilies. His lips, of course. Yeah, his lips are lilies. Okay, now this is, I think, another step in the text which we'll have to really work on. In the usual way we would read biblical poetry, we would say that part A and part B are parallels, right? I am a rose and I am a lily. These two are somehow, there's some kind of analogy between the two of them, and they are both descriptions of the same image in different ways. The Tzar doesn't take this in this way. They actually would speak of these two moments as two phases. And this verse, in a sense, is a drama. There is some kind of dynamics taking place in the verse which we would never think of or recognize, but for the Tzar, and this is very typical of how the Tzar sometimes work with verses, they will take the structure or the order of the words and they say there is a development from word to word. You think it's just one sentence, but actually each word is an occasion of itself, an event of itself, and there is a whole drama taking place. And you have it a bit here. First, the first phase is the Rose of the Sharon, the second phase is the Lily of the Valleys, and there is a whole drama taking place from here to here. I am the Rose of the Sharon, and afterwards, and then I become the Lily of the Valley. This is just to kind of frame what they're doing here. Now let's do it. Let's take it backwards, actually, from the, because the last sentence says it in the most explicit manner, and then we'll see how it goes, how they reach it. A lily first arose. Yeah, you see this? When she wishes to unite with the king. And here the metaphors are explicitly erotic. Yeah? First she is a rose when she wishes to unite with the king. She's called a rose. After she has become united with him, with the king, with those kisses, she's called Lily, since it is written, his lips are as lilies. Let's take this sentence and then go backwards. The big drama is between... We've discussed the flower as yearning for water, we've discussed the flower as praying, as praising, as in some kind of relationship with God or with the river, but here the sexual imagery, it becomes explicit. We have the flower
meaning the Shekhinah, this feminine entity of God, united with the king, with the masculine aspect of God, before this sexual union, she is the rose of the Shavuot. Afterwards, she becomes a lily, because, says the Zohar, quoting another verse from the Song of Songs, his lips are like lilies. So when, and this is, yeah, this is in the Song of Songs. Mm-hmm. When he kisses her with his lily lips, she becomes a lily through his lips.
Could this be that I am the rose of Sharon, I'm a symbol, mm-hmm. I'm on the prowl, I'm on the lookout, I want something, I mate, I now become, with my mate, one. I'm united now, mm-hmm. I become husband and wife, if you like.
So this,
because she takes on his name, Lily.
That's interesting. So I think that's part of it. Soon we'll see that we'll develop this in other ways. But yes, I think on one aspect it's for sure. The rose of the Sharon here is a virgin image, yeah, in a sense. Yeah,
it's she's the source. It's the source.
What?
It's the source. It's coming from the source, from the waters. This the origin of the waters, right? Mm-hmm. That's where it originally starts. This place, so it's in a sense has both the feminine and masculine aspect at that point.
Yeah.
At the source itself, then it breaks down into again feminine and the masculine. It just can you see where I'm going? Okay, Sharon. Originally, the Sharon, according to the text here, is at the source of the waters.
Oh, yeah.
Follow?
Yeah.
And so at that point, is it not a masculine or feminine? It's the source. It's both feminine and masculine. Androgynous.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes down and moves down into where it's the receptive, the lips of the masculine.
Yeah. Oh,
it's changing.
I see. It's possible, but I think here that you can think of her as a feminine image just before intercourse. Yeah, I think what you're saying is possible for our last paragraph, where the Shavon was the source of rivers as well. But I think my feeling here, I'm not sure, is that these two are, it's the same character, but the same, and this is a masculine text thinking about feminine images, but it's in a sense two phases in the... in the, I don't know, perhaps you mean in the process of this flower. She starts as a chavetzela and she matures through union with the king to become a rose. I think this is where they're hinting at.
No, Lily.
Lily, I'm sorry. Yeah, this is very confusing because in modern Hebrew, Shoshana is rose.
Yeah,
so I always. Now let's read the whole thing again and see how they get there. Come and see. At first, she is green like a rose.
Whatever, I don't know, I've never seen that, but I'm not sure they know exactly what flower they are talking about. But she's green.
Before it opens, it's green.
Ah, okay. Oh, that's possible. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, so this is the flower before blossoming. Great. That's great. Right.
And that goes along with
it. Great. Whose leaves are green, so this is, and she's clothed, so this is really the kind of a virginal image. Afterwards, a lily, Shoshana. She is red with white colors. This is something that we'll develop in a minute, the red and white thing, so we'll leave this one. Shoshana with six leaves. I think they're just playing with Shoshana and Sheshil, which means six. Shoshana. Because she changes, and this is Aramaic, ishtaniyat. In Hebrew, the ishtanot. Okay? So they have this, so the shin and the taf is the noon, they have enough letters there to work with. Shoshana doesn't have also six leaves, she also has this notion of changing, as in Hebrew, the ishtanot and Shoshana. She changes from color to color and varies, shaniyat, her colors. These two aspects, the fact that she has red and white, and the fact that she changes colors, will be developed at the end of the paragraph. So we'll see this in a moment. So at first she is green, and this your interpretation I think is great. Green, she's closed, she's not yet blossoming, she is just waiting to unite with the king, but she's not there yet. But when she does blossom and unite with the king, she doesn't have one color but two. She is red and white, and she has this notion of changing colors. A lily, first a rose, when she wishes to unite with the king, she's called a rose. After she has become united with him, with the king, with those kisses, she is called lily. Since it is written, her lips are, his lips, are as lilies. A lily of the valleys, for she changes her colors, sometimes for good, sometimes for evil, sometimes for mercy, sometimes for judgment. And this last sentence is interesting. On the one hand, I mean, the story, again, that the story should be in the Zohar that that once she is united with the king, it's a happy ending. This is what the Zohar always aims at, that you know, that this will be this divine union between the masculine and feminine aspects of God, and this union is good. But something happens to this flower who blossomed from the green virginal rose into the lily, and she becomes actually a much more interesting, in a sense, but perhaps also dangerous character, because now, once she has united with the king and perhaps blossomed sexually, she changes her colors, right? She has red and white, and she changes her colors, sometimes for good, sometimes for evil, sometimes for mercy, sometimes for judgment. Now, mercy and judgment, if you recall, are these two, the right and the left, and these are two aspects of God, but also of the world in Zoharic imagery. The harsh aspect which of judgment and the softer and more benevolent aspect of mercy. Many times identified with the colors red and white, red being the aspect of judgment and white being the aspect of mercy. Here also identified with good and evil. And this rose, this lily, once she has been united with the king and blossomed, she left her perhaps, you know, virginal green behind and turns into a full feminine flower. But this full feminine flower is depicted here actually having this double aspect. Once she has blossomed, she has two colors, and she can change them, and she can move from mercy to judgment, and she can move from good to evil. In this structure of the Sefirot, I would say this because this explains part of the text, but I don't think all of it. This Sefirah of Malchut, the Shekhinah, is the one which is most vulnerable to the forces of evil, because she is the closest one to the inferior worlds, and she can be separated from the male and be left alone. This sefirah is the most vulnerable for outer forces of evil to snatch her and use her and sometimes even abuse her. This is not necessarily a most flattering image of femininity, but it is an image that this feminine entity Shekhinah could be united with God. But if she will not be united with God, she could fornicate or be adulterous with other forces of evil, and this would have disastrous effects. This is in the Kabbalistic structure, and this perhaps is hinted at with this notion of now that she has blossomed and she has united with the king, she can actually use this for good or for evil. But even if we don't take the whole structure in mind, we can think that there is actually these two parts of the verse have become two images of femininity. Divine femininity in this case, but divine femininity also reflects the text notion of femininity as such. There is a green rose-like, in this case, image of a virginal femininity, which is closed yet, enclosed, guarded, enclosed and all, guarded and protected, but in fact with no relationship to any other, and therefore just yearning for a union. And this is the young or pre-sexual feminine image. The rose, the lily, once, which is in union with the king, which is basically the positive outcome of this dynamics, this is where things should lead, is actually perceived as actually being, having this kind of double aspect to it, being susceptible to evil, changing colors, not having one identity, and actually being more, perhaps more dynamic, and perhaps more rich as a character, but on the other side, being more susceptible to forces which are from the outside. Yes.
You know, if you're trying to read this as an eroticized extended metaphor, it can take you to some very interesting and subversive implications theologically, because it's clear that a lot of this reflects, you know, the male puzzlement over female creativity.
Yeah.
Because all this reference to deep places and so on and so forth really is a reflection of the puzzlement that males feel about the source of life.
True.
And this flower comes out of the depths, as creation comes out of the depth of the female body, whether it's a floral one or a human one.
And definitely.
And that's all a reference to those deep places.
Yes, I agree.
The innocence of it, you know, that's the Garden of Eden and so on.
Yeah.
And then it's not until the fertilization occurs that the potential for new life is created. But of course, that's never the end of the story. Potential for new life, also drawing on the metaphor of the Garden of Eden, implies, you know, having tasted of the wrong tree and of understanding the difference between good and evil, which means free will, which means the potential for choosing good or evil, which is kind of like the ultimate mystery of God creating the world and then almost having lost control over it because it was B'Tselem. Man was created in his image, which means that he had to have free will, which means that God can only call the shots up to a point. Excuse me. And after that point, you know, he actually has to react. The subversive potential, of course, in all this, if you're interested in theological images, is that Israel, who plays the role in this whole complex relationship of creation and worlds and so on, plays the female role, but the subversive potential is that in some sense God needs the female opposite his male in order to somehow realize himself in some way, which very easily becomes sacrilegious. I mean, if you're of a fundamentalist frame of mind.
Yeah.
I don't know if the person who wrote this text didn't have that little agenda going on at the same time, which is one of the reasons why so many generations of Jews have regarded the Zohar as being tremendously dangerous.
True. Yes.
And you kind of sense that potential in this excerpt, when you think about it, both in the sense of God's implied dependence and in the sense of the loss of control of the creation of the Shoshanah, which emerges from the Chavetzelet, having this potential to go any which way.
Yeah, I totally agree with. I think there is a strongly subversive. I mean, again, a potential subversive potential. I think that's I think the best. I mean, I don't know if it's a subversive text, but it has its consequences are both in, I would say, the human realm of gender images and the fact that yes, as a text written by men, you can feel that there is this sense of puzzlement and this notion of depth, which is on the one hand, depth, and then when female sexuality does assert itself, it's dangerous, and it can go either way, and you can find, you can feel this this kind of
perplexity about how to handle it, and in the theological level, because first of all, for sure, this text and many have, I think, seen the Zohar as dangerous because this text does, first of all, says that God is not exactly one. Even if God is, He is one, but divided into some, and it's not, He's not exactly masculine, but He has feminine aspects, and that these feminine aspects are necessary, and that they have some kind of, the feminine has, and so, and mankind has some kind of free will. Once they are created and they are part of this drama, they can move either way, and these aspects, I think, are. The Tsar sometimes perceives them as dangerous, but the Tsar is also the one that articulates them as possible. I mean, once this flower has blossomed, they could have ended the text if they wanted to with, yeah? After she has become united with him, with the king, with those kisses, his lips are like lilies, end point. Fine. And then, you know, it's happy ever after. You know, the virgin flower has emerged, and now she's married, and everything's fine. But it's not fine. They actually realize that the drama continues afterwards, and she has a whole spectrum of possible moves she can do now. Some of them, the Tsar will state as dangerous. We perhaps can consider it as some kind of fear of the feminine, but it does articulate a story which is ongoing. It doesn't end with this union with the king. And therefore has a subversive potential. Yes, I totally agree with this. Yes, please.
Well, I mean, while I'm sure there's like a million interpretations of this, and I don't really understand a lot about like what you're talking about, the Sphira, and I don't really understand that in a larger sense.
Yeah.
In terms of like just what I saw in this was less of the feminine, like the lowest Sphira is like being this actual representation of the feminine, like
mm-hmm.
the female woman,
mm-hmm.
rather like a representation of more humanity and like this struggle that humanity has with its inner divine and its inner humanity or something that's separated from God that always searches to be closer to God.
Yeah.
And receiving like this whole story of the individual or the people or the, you know, the Jewish people or whatever it is towards the enlightenment of pulling towards God.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole, you know, like you have chet and like how these stories align in terms of the Jewish intellectual development and how the individual goes through this process of not understanding and coming closer to that. But once you become closer to the understanding of all that we have, Torah, whatever it is, your knowledge studied throughout the years and years and years of, I don't know, coming closer to God, which that path of study is how, I guess, most Jews see coming closer to God in action, but through the Torah, that through that, even once you have studied your whole life, you have come closer, as close as you can, through practice, through whatever it is, that in the end of the day, you're still this divided character that is does chayt, that is doomed or given the difficulty of being split and not divine.
Yeah.
And that you always have this play, even when you have come, you know, as far as it comes to the end of your life, you know, practice, you know, none of us are really extreme practicing, like, I don't know, Jews, but even in that extreme situation, when you know live the word to the T, and you know every day are sitting in cheder and you know whatever, at the end of the day you're still human.
Yeah.
And you can't be God. And
that's
like the beauty of what you're creating.
That's a wonderful reading. I think in a sense, it's a tricky thing, this notion of femininity and masculinity in the Zohar, because on the one hand there are entities, but there are also relational modes. I mean, you could be in their world. Again, it's very different for how we would perhaps perceive this. But you are feminine in relation to someone, and you could be masculine in relation to another. And therefore, it might say something about how they perceive women if they call this feminine and this masculine. But yes, if all the Jews or mankind are feminine in relation to God, this has something. It has much more to say perhaps about what is the drama of mankind. Not just of women, but also of men, and and definitely, as we've seen, I think, 2 weeks ago also, or 3 weeks ago, when the rabbis say, we are, yeah, or Origen says, I am the bride, men imagine themselves in feminine images in relation to God, but speak about their drama as men or just as humans. So, yes.
You said, in the middle, you said the feminine is, you were talking about the relationship, and you said it's the receiver, and a lot of these situations is the receiver.
Yes.
And you see humanity as the receiver of God's word and the Torah.
Definitely.
And this is,
I think this is very, it stands at the core of many of the way these texts work. Yes, so, definitely so.
On the other hand, the feminine in this passage, as well as even the Song of Songs, is very active.
Mm-hmm.
Very active. And in this section, this the king, the male, is totally passive.
It's totally passive. I mean, I think one of the things I love about this passage is it's about a flower. But so this flower does so much. I mean, it's not even the bride. It's just a flower standing there in a valley, enclosed from all sides. But so much drama just with this one flower. Yes, I agree. I mean, the king is almost absent in the text. He's a river or a king. She yearns to him. She praises. He kisses her once, but that's all.
She
becomes united with those kisses. But he is really at the background, and it's her drama. Definitely so. Yes, I agree. These are two poems written by the Israeli poet known only by her first name of Zelda. Zelda is quite a phenomenon in the Israeli poetry scene. She is she comes from a Chabad Hasidic family. She's actually a cousin of the last Chabad Rebbe, and she has been a strongly observant woman for all of her life. But once she has started publishing poetry, she started publishing, I think. Her first book came out in the late 60s. I mean, she started publishing in journals a bit earlier, but her first book came out in the late 60s, making her kind of a double anomaly at the time, a Hasidic woman writing poetry and an Israeli poet coming from Hasidic circles. I mean, this is before I don't know if it's an upsurge, but I mean, since the 90s, you can find more and more religious poets in the Israeli literary scene. This has been much more rare at the time, but her poetry has been widely accepted and become strongly canonized by the Israeli public. And she become and many of the strongest, secular, although I'm not a big fan of these terms, but strongest secular poets of the time, like Yona Volach and Meir Wiesenthier, have been her admirers, and she has been much influenced by her.
How did her own community regard her poetry?
She didn't live in a Haredi community, so she lived in Shaarei Chesed, which is in Jerusalem. It's a more unique, as a different kind of atmosphere. They have accepted her all in all. And her poetry, although you can find subversive elements in them, her poetry there's some kind of a soft side to her poetry, which in a sense perhaps negates objection. You can see much of her poems. They are complex, but there is also a strong. You can feel the religiosity in them in a sense. I think they're. I would definitely say that for me, for example, growing up as when I was studying in a yeshiva, she was the acceptable poet to read in the Bet Midrash. Right, you could not read Yehuda Amichai or Dalia Rabikovich or Yona Volach. Definitely, you cannot read Yona Volach. But you can have her book on the shelf next to the Talmud and other, because she was canonized also as part of. So she was accepted. She was the acceptable poet. Otniel, which is about itself.
Is she the poet that Amos Oz writes about?
Yeah, she's the poet Amos Oz writes.
As a boy.
Yeah, that she was her. She was his teacher, right? In Story of Love and Darkness, right? Yeah, she's one. Now, in her first book, and many of her texts are imbued with images from her Hasidic and religious upbringing, and I want to take a look at two poems published in her first book, Pnai, which means leisure, from 1967. And these two poems are in the first book, have been published side by side. So what you have here is basically, I added the English translations, of course, but what you have here is the way they have been published. And the first one is called Chavatzelet HaSharon, Rose of the here it's Lily of the Sharon, fine. We'll never, but okay, whatever. And I see the translator has subverted again. And the second one is Kol Shoshana, or Each Rose. So we'll have to switch Rose and Lily once again. But already by putting these poems one next to the other, she at least refers to the verse. Because she has one on Chavatzelet HaSharon and then another one on Shoshana, one next to the other, and she kind of invites us to invoke at least the biblical verse. It's not the Zohar, which we've just been reading, although perhaps the Zohar as well. So I would like to take a look on these two poems and see what kind of flowers emerge. We talked about a male text dealing with feminine imagery within the Zohar. Here we have a woman writer taking these two flowers and reflecting upon them as well. A woman writer well acquainted with the Zohar and with the Kabbalistic interpretations, as well as with the Song of Songs. So let's start with the first song, which is Chavatzelet HaSharon. I will read it in Hebrew, and then just to get a bit of the sound of the poetry, and then I would be happy if one would read it in English instead. Chavatzelet HaSharon. Kravai libi nafshi yotzim el nichoach ha-chavatzelet. נשימת האושר, מסוס החולות. הנה עולה אליי מן התחב, מן הריק, מעין אופק, פורחת בכנפי הלבנות, שוב העולם ממשות מלוטשת, מזל עליון, בעל קדושה ודאי. Can someone please read it in English? Our guest read, yes please.
Okay, Lily of Sharon. My entrails, my heart, my soul, yearn for the lily's fragrance, the breath of happiness, the joys of sands. Here she comes up to me from the dankness, from the void, from no horizon. Flourishing in her white wings, once again the world is a polished substance, supernal fortune, definitely possessing holiness.
Okay. So it seems this song starts actually with a specific flower, a real flower that has fragrance. Yeah, as Liz asked, so this lily has a fragrance, and it grows in the sands. So it seems that at least for her, as an Israeli poet, she has a specific flower in mind when she speaks about this lily, and it's white, as the Israeli modern flower called Chavatzelet HaSharon is. It's a white flower. But let's see how this specific, very concrete flower emerges for her as she yearns for it. So we have a woman yearning for a flower. We talked about flowers yearning for God. Here we have a woman yearning for a flower. My entrails, my heart, my soul. It starts with a physical image. My entrails towards an emotional one, perhaps my heart, and then my soul. I'm sorry. Yeah, well, it's interesting. It's kravai. Kravai is the inner parts of the yeah, inner parts of the.
Yeah. Kishkes.
Okay. Okay. So yeah, that would be yeah, my kishk. Yearn for the lily's fragrance. But I think we do have to think of the physicality of it, because it starts with the physical image. Yeah, kavai has, kishkis is a good word for that. It has all the meanings we need for yearn for the lily's fragrance. This fragrance is the breath of happiness, the joy of sands. And it's interesting, this notion of joy of sands as something which is on the one hand, I don't know, a full experience, but sands give us also the fleeting image. And I think... I'm sorry?
The joy of sands.
The joy of sands. Mesos acholot. So, sands, I mean, sands at least has the image of actually something which is not stable and not... I'm sorry?
It's not permanent.
The joy of sands is on the one hand, there is joy here, but not something which is, you know,
it's not stable.
It's not stable. It's shifting. Exactly. It's the joy of sand. I want to especially to look at the next sentences in which the flower emerges for her, because she yearns for this breath of happiness and the joy of sand, but now she almost sees it. Here she comes. In the Song of Songs, we have, you know, who is she that comes from the desert? Yeah. So here she comes up to me from the dankness, from the void, from no horizon. And it's interesting because in a sense this emergence of the flower to her, the flower which is also feminine, she comes, in Hebrew Chavatzelet is feminine, she emerges from dankness, which I think in our imagery doesn't have necessarily positive connotations. It's things which are old, I don't know, and rotting and decaying. And perhaps even worse, she's emerging from the void or from no horizon, from nothingness. And this flower is blossoming from everything which seems to be either from negation itself, void and no horizon, or if there is some kind of substance, this substance is of dankness, of decay. But from all this flower emerges almost as a vision. I mean, and I think there's a notion here. I mean, she yearns for the lily's fragrance, but the here she comes up from the dankness seems to be as almost as a vision. She suddenly appears, this flower, this chavatzelet, in front of her from everything which seems to be decaying or almost non-existing. Flourishing in her white wings. She is a bird. The word here, it's interesting. She's saying this porachat. Porachat in Hebrew is flourishing, but also, when a bird spread her wings, you can change, a bird can also, you can use the word porachat also for a bird spreading her wings. So the translation it's slightly lost here in the translation. Porachat b'chnafei alevanot can mean flourishing in white wings, but also spreading her white wings. Right. Once this flower has done that, once again the world is a polished substance, supernal fortune, definitely possessing holiness. And so this specific flower, which again she has, I think, the botanic flower, which is called in Hebrew Chavatzelet Sharon, this white flower from the sands. Once this flower has emerged from dankness and void, and no horizon from this nothingness, once she has spread her white wings, suddenly she changes the whole world, and the world, and here we are definitely in religious language. Yeah, the world is a polished substance, as perhaps opposed to the sands, which are shifting. Now the world is crystallized into a polished substance. The world exists. We had void and no horizon and sands and dankness, and suddenly the world, once she has spread her wings, is a polished substance. The word, Hebrew word is mamashut, mamashut, a reality, it exists. Supernal fortune, we had supernal king earlier, right? Or supernal something in the Zohar. So the world has supernal fortune, definitely possessing holiness. So it's the vision of the flower, of this really concrete botanical flower, becomes a religious experience for her, in which the world, this flower emerged from nothingness or from dankness, but once she sees this flower, the world, and the story, the poem ends with the world definitely possessing holiness. And from very shifty grounds in the beginning of the poem, we end with some kind of notion of some kind of certainty that the world is possessing holiness. And what made the change, it seems, is the emergence of the flower.
Does the use of the, is this a stretch to suggest that the use of the metaphor of wings makes you think of, by association, of the Shekhinah? Because we're always saying,
definitely. I think yes. I think it's not as far-fetched at all. I mean, there is, because she does something here, and soon we'll see what she does with the rose, aka Lily. That while she speaks of a specific flower, she makes this flower into she makes her in this flower into the cornerstone of her religious experience of holiness. And therefore, yes, there is this notion of this. I think she is using this notion of the Chavatzelet as Shekhinah, which we already have seen in the Zohar, and we will see soon again. Because there is something, we talked about the mythical aspect, and I think there is something mythical here as well. Both in the negative emergence, the fact that she emerges from nothingness, this flower that emerges from the void, it's almost an act of creation, of the creation from of ex nihilo, right? The creation of total nothingness. Suddenly, a flower emerges, and once this flower emerges, everything becomes stable, and not just stable but holy. So this. This experience, which is a religious experience, I think does lead us to the possible idea of the flower becoming a bird, becoming the Shekhinah. So it definitely is. Yes.
I like Zelda very much.
Yeah.
And I feel that this poem really shows her in her characteristic way. And the impression I have of her is that she deals with despair.
Mm-hmm.
She lost her husband.
Sure.
Early.
Yes.
They were in love.
Yes.
And so her poems are about loss and longing.
Mm-hmm.
And for her, the natural world, the sea and the shore, for example, are very much a part of what gives her the sense that there is a holiness. And
yes.
She also looks at plants and natural phenomena
yes.
as a way to tune in that the despair, the pit that she's always on the edge of, is not necessarily where she needs to go. And for this reason, this is why I think I like her poetry.
Yeah.
It's because I can look over and see it over there. But nevertheless, there's the sea, there's the sand, there are these incredible things that come up.
Yeah.
And then the miracle occurs, and you realize that there is something else going on here. And from just a purely human point of view, I think you've got her, really got her.
Yeah.
But from a human point of view, not even going into the Zohar or anything like that, she brings an incredible sense of magic to the world around her.
I think. Thank you for saying this. I think it's important. It's definitely important, even for what we've just from the move we even made here. Because first of all, it's very clear that Zelda looks at the flower. Yeah. I mean, when we read the Zohar, it's unclear that they ever even thought. I mean, how the flower looks like, you know, saying that the Shoshana has six leaves or whatever. I mean, it seems that she really looks at the flower, and the flower itself gives her this experience. It's not mystical in the abstract sense, in any way. And I think in this sense it's true. She looks at nature, and nature gives her comfort, because she does experience the world as a void and as no horizon. and dankness. She does experience the world as
the
such.
The sense of despair
is always there. Yeah. But once this flower, the real flower emerges, then this flower does give comfort, and this comfort is a religious comfort, because this flower makes the world holy. Mm-hmm. So it's always double layered, because I think she knows what the Chavetzelet means and what other, and when she calls it Chavetzelet HaSharon and puts next to it a song about Rosh Hashanah, she knows that the Song of Song is there. But none of this more sophisticated literary devices hinders her very direct and even I would say simple relation to nature. Not simplistic, but yeah, I don't know what good word would be for that, because it's not simple, but I don't know what word would work for that, but a direct experience of nature in which nature itself gives her comfort and holiness. Definitely so. Yes.
That's what I find enchanting about.
Yes, I agree.
There's one more image that supports that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the transition from formlessness,
mm-hmm,
or void,
mm-hmm,
to form.
Yes.
You know, and beauty is the source of the thing. So the sands and the breath of happiness, you know, what are sands is the ultimate formlessness. You know,
yes.
Little nothings. Little pieces of something just spread randomly.
Yeah.
And then the wind comes, and who knows who sends the wind or what the wind represents, but suddenly forms the sand into incredible dunes and sculptures and beautiful contours. And that's where she gets the joy of sand.
I think so too, yeah. And also this, I think joy for her in many times is a dynamic notion. You have no images of dancing, I would say, and as joy, and perhaps also here, sands are shifting, but they also have the possibility to dance. They're in motion.
And the colors change.
Yes.
The light changes, and she's very sensitive to
that's true. Things. That's very true. Yeah, you want to? Okay, let's take a look also on the rose song, and then perhaps also see how I would like also to think of how the dynamics of the second poem. This is a typical Israeli state. We don't have different words. How the second poem reflects the first one. So again, I'll read it in Hebrew and then... Kol Shoshana. Kol Shoshana hi'i. Shel ha-shalom ha-muvtach, ha-shalom ha-nitzchi. Bechol Shoshana mitgoreret tzipor tzapirit, ששמה וחיתתו. ונדמה... כה קרוב אור השושנה, כה קרוב ניחוחה, כה קרוב שקט העלים, כה קרוב אותו אי. קח סירה וחצה את ים האש.
Each rose is an island of the promised peace, the eternal peace. In every rose dwells a sapphire bird whose name is They Shall Beat Their Swords. And the life of the rose seems so near, and its fragrance so near, and the silence of the leaves so near, the island, that island so near. Take a boat and cross a sea of fire.
Okay. So we had a white lily, and now we're having a red rose, and I think it's at least the fire at the end makes, you know, justifies the redness. Here, if we had the specific Chavetzelet HaSharon, one flower which she looks at, here we have each rose, every Kol Shoshana, every rose. She talks about the, can you say species for flowers? Yeah. And each one of these many flowers, many roses, is an island, she says, of the promised peace, the eternal peace. And in every rose dwells a sapphire bird whose name is They Shall Be. This I think is simply untranslatable, because she takes the first word of the verse of the prophet saying they shall beat their swords into, yeah. And the Hebrew is the first word. The Hebrew is the chitetu. So first of all, it's only one word, and I think she simply plays with the sound of it, the chitetu, which could sound perhaps bird-like, yeah, with the two at the end. I guess she has this kind of, she takes, and this words of the prophet becomes the sound of a bird.
What's the significance of the sapphire bird? You know, why not some other kind of bird?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, sapphire can have several images. If we go, you know, back. One is that after Mount Sinai, when the 70 elders have seen God, they've seen they've seen like a brick of sapphire under his legs. They've seen some kind of sapphire under God's legs. So sapphire has something to do with divinity. The sapphire is probably bluish, right? Yeah, it's a bluish. I know of some like interpretations trying to take this into that this is a Shekhinah, because blue is sometimes the color of the Shekhinah in many ways. So the tzipor, again, the bird, as we've seen earlier with the wings, is an image of Shekhinah. I don't know. It's possible, but I don't have like one option that I feel satisfied with here.
Later?
Yeah.
On that one? Maybe it would be nice to ask how would a sapphire bird make you feel? It would be exquisite.
Yeah.
And she does this with some of her other poems. She has golden fish in the sea. Mm. This is totally imaginary, but if you imagine golden fish, suddenly
it's beautiful.
You're in another universe.
That's true.
And
that's good.
So maybe imagine how a sapphire bird would be.
It may, like a bird,
suddenly
a jewel.
Something else.
Yeah.
Now.
That's true. Now here, but it's interesting that but let's return perhaps a bit backwards. We have the notion of the rose as being an island. In the first poem, we've seen one flower emerging as a bird from nothingness and making the whole world stable. Here we have the notion of a rose as an island, which is first and foremost an image of isolation. An island is. We've seen in the Zohar the rose being enclosed, right? But enclosed by everything. Here we have an island by definition is an isolated element. So I mean, if we just, you know, this is almost visual. I mean, each of these flowers, I'm going to be very, very simplistic here, but each of these flowers is, if each rose is an island, then by definition there is a sea, which we don't talk about yet, we'll discuss by the end of the poem. But definition, there is something outside of this island which is not eternal peace and not promised peace, and that this specific flower is separate, is isolated within this sea. So we might have many, many roses, but each of these roses is an island by itself where there is peace, but in isolation.
Mm. Different interpretation. There is a rose called peace.
There is? Wow.
Also, in the UK, for instance, and maybe we saw this, roses are grown in Ireland, if you like.
Really?
They are grown, and you have lawn around them.
Wow.
So that they are normally grown on their own, because they're actually quite fragile. You can't move them.
Mm-hmm.
So, maybe she has that image.
That's interesting.
From botanical.
Yeah.
Places.
So a cluster of roses.
And as I said, there is a rose called peace.
Interesting. Oh, I didn't know all this. Thank you.
It's a white rose, by the way.
Thank you.
Or if roses are so fragile and precious that each one would be extraordinarily precious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a set apart. It wouldn't just be a bunch of flowers. On
yeah,
the
definitely. Yeah, again, and then the sapphire bird, and in it, it's a nest of a sapphire bird, so definitely it's a precious one.
Also, yes. I think if you go back to the original text, Shir Shirim, where it says, I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys, the next line is like a lily among thorns.
So it's
an island in the sense that each rose is an island within the,
right.
Surrounded by the
sure.
thorns.
And definitely if she's an island of peace and around it is a sea of thorns, so you really have this image, that strong thing. But in any case, we do have this kind of, in this notion of isolation and a tension between the flower and its surrounding, what we had earlier is the lily emerging from nothingness and actually stabilizing its surrounding. Here we have much more of a sense of tension and isolation between what this flower can do to its surrounding and what it can't. It doesn't have still the stabilizing effect. And the light of the rose seems so near, and its fragrance so near, and the silence of the leaves so near, that island so near. Take a boat and cross the sea of fire. Now, and here, I think this last stanza has, I think, a very, actually a destabilizing effect in a way, because, we have this secret sapphire bird in this flower, and there is peace. This is written in 1967, by the way, or published in 1967. And there will be peace and this promise for peace. And it's so close. I mean, each flower, right? I mean, again, these are specific flowers. This is not metaphysical entities. These are not, you know, this is not just the Shekhinah. This is just this flower. And there is, and it's so close. And all you have to do is just take a boat and cross the sea of fire. Basically, do what possibly cannot be done. Or not very easily so.
What do you think the sea of fire means?
I think it's the petals.
You think it's the petals?
Yeah, I think if it's a red rose, this is my notion. So yeah, it's just and this is where the bird is.
Oh, you have to
cross this.
Okay.
this is one option. But another option is that everything surrounding each rose, the world is a sea of fire.
Life.
Is a sea of fire. Yeah. Life.
The critical word is need the met.
Yeah, and it seems
so close.
Yeah.
It seems so approachable and accessible, but in fact, to get to
it's a sea of fire.
You have to cross a sea of fire.
Exactly.
That's how God has talked about a lot of the time, I feel like.
Mm-hmm.
This idea of it being right there, like God here, but God is everywhere, but it's not.
Yeah, just do this, but you can't do that. Exactly.
This does seem like a strange. There's a footnote here, 43.
Yeah.
So what was that referred to? What's that footnote?
I think it's just a footnote for the book. I took the translation.
So here's my next.
Yeah.
So this is the actual photograph of the pages that appears in the book. Is that what you said?
Yeah, the Hebrew, not the English.
Not the English, because right across from this is the footnote number 40. What happened to 41 and 42?
No, this is from a specific.
In the English, it's not.
No, there's this. I'm sorry. No. But.
Connections.
But it seems, although I mean this song. In many ways, I don't know. It's almost perhaps more pessimistic song than the one within a Chavetzelet song, in the sense that it starts actually with the great promise of the rose, and ends with very gently, because Zelda is a gentle kind of poet, very gently saying this promise is not easily accessed. I mean, you feel this in the flower. Again, she watches the flower and has this vision of what potential and what promise there is in this rose, but in order to reach it, there is a sea of fire. I always have really this image of a boat sailing on the petals. But I guess this is me.
She's an activist. But she acknowledges that the sea is called dangerous or difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, cross it up.
Yeah. Take.
Yeah,
there's.
Don't just meditate about it or complain about how difficult. Yeah. Goddamn boat, do something
about it, definitely. So. Yes, but it's interesting because it starts with this kind of meditation, watching the flower and seeing sapphire birds in it, but the end is urging for action. But this urging for action is also, I'm not sure if this is an activist tone. It could be read in an activist tone, or perhaps something slightly more ironic. Not ironic, but
she could be talking to herself and saying, get going, lady.
Mm-hmm.
Don't go into the pits of despair. Take that boat and go there.
She loves, also, if you go for a rose, most roses are pretty roses.
Yeah. Often to get to the rose, it's a bloody painful thing to actually get that flower. Because you are pricking yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the burning.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
She's using that metaphor.
That's interesting.
If you try to get the rose,
you'll get.
You're grasping it out. You have to go through pain
in order to reach. Wow, that's great. That's great.
And fire sounds like war, doesn't it?
I think it sounds like war. And it could be life as war, but I think it could be war specifically because we're talking about, you know, the promise of peace. She evokes the prophet of beating the swords into what? I will never. Yeah, so it's a promise. This has to do with actual war. So I agree. Sea of Fire should go.
In Hebrew, you have the choice of parsing the imperative in masculine or feminine. She parses it in masculine. She doesn't say
Sirah, she says
Kah Sirah, which is masculine.
Yeah.
Maybe he's not unconnected to 1967.
That's the active principle.
I think there is this choice of making it masculine is important because in a sense, if we do have the Zohar in mind of the femininity of these flowers, yeah, and the flower actually as the Shekhinah, as a feminine aspect, that there is the person who needs to arrive to the flower here is described as a man, not her. She is watching this, but the person in at least in the Hebrew invited to take the boat and reach the peace which is in this feminine flower is a man.
I think there's also maybe not so much in the Hebrew, but at least in English, a duality.
Mm-hmm.
From the beginning, that if the rose is an island of promised peace, eternal peace, it sounds very nice, but it can also mean death.
Interesting, possibly. Yeah, I think it's possible.
It also can refer back to the Zohar, of this duality of the of the flower,
of
for
the
good
white
and for
white.
Evil.
Yeah. And I want to return to this duality for a moment, just to think of these two flowers as, because she does something which is Zohar-like, but not exactly the Zohar, turning the Chavetzeret and the Shoshanah into very different flowers and to very different experiences of life. The white and the red here are different flowers. The Chavetzeret, the lily of the Sharon is white. The Shoshana seems to be red from this notion of fire. But the movements of these two flowers, the emotions, or even I would say the drama they entail, are almost opposite. The Chavetzeret, this one Chavetzeret emerging from the void, stabilizes the world and making it into definitely possessing holiness. The poem ends with this notion of stability and affirming the holiness of the world. The Shoshana song goes just almost the opposite direction. It starts with this notion of peace, eternal peace, and watching this flower, having this almost stable experience with the flower, and ending with telling you it's not that easy. Yes, okay, there is a promise of peace over there, but it's an island, and the world is not stable around it. The world is not possessed with holiness and supernal future. The world is a sea of fire outside of this island, and you have to cross this fire to get it. So the world is actually much less stable than the song kind of seduces us to believe in the beginning of it, the poem. So these two flowers with Zelda are also not, as opposed to the Shir HaShirim, she does take the Zoharic image of saying, this flower, these are two phases, or these are two mindsets, the Chavetzeret and the Shoshana. I think she does continue that, saying these are different worlds, and they are almost opposite in her mindset. There is the virginal Chavetzeret, which seen in the Zohar, the green Chavetzeret, which is virginal, here becomes a promise of holiness and a promise of stability, while the more mature sexual Shoshana here becomes a promise of peace, but with a deep, perhaps also mature understanding that the world is a sea of fire, and reaching this peace is not as easy as it might seem. So in a sense, she doesn't, you know, evoke the Zohar, but she perhaps thinks like the Zohar in the way she posits these two flowers vis-a-vis each other, even in the same, again, page, as two movements of experiencing the world, experiencing holiness and experiencing real life by watching a flower. I think we'll finish with this today, unless there are any more comments.